Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and I'll be flying solo, at least from the standpoint of hosting, but not to worry. My co-host, Dr. Matt Polacek, will be back with us in January to kick off the new year with style and gusto. Now, for those of you that have been listening, sending in questions and comments, thank you so much. It adds so much to the show, and it's something that we dearly appreciate. And please continue to help spread the word that every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring you special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain, while bringing answers and options to making your lives happier, healthier, and more successful. Now, this show, we will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. And we will introduce you to talented authors, caring people with new innovations in the areas of health, security, and fun for you and your family. Now, with our experience working with families in crisis, we have really been blessed and very fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields who are all working to make this world a better place for all of us. Now, today we have a very interesting subject, and I'll just start with a piece of information, a piece of law that was passed. In 2015, California lawmakers voted to approve SB 277. And that was a bill that ended granting vaccine exemptions to parents who would cite personal or religious reasons, although they did put an exemption in to allow medical exemptions. But what this rule has done is it's really had a huge blow to the anti-vaccine movement. But after the lawmakers cited the 147 people that contracted measles in Disneyland in late 2014, they decided that this was going to be their decision. And, they stated that, that they believe that in order to prevent widespread outbreaks of measles, mumps, and rubella, that they believe that the national vaccine rate must be between 96 and 99%. Now, at the time of the measles outbreak, California's vaccination rate for these diseases was between 50 and 86%. So, to some, immunizations against childhood illnesses are touted as one of the greatest achievements in modern medicine. To others, it's looked at as something to where maybe Big Pharma has seen another way to make a lot of money. So, the question is, if it is the greatest achievement for modern medicine, why would parents rather risk their child contracting a deadly disease than simply receiving a round of vaccines? Well, to talk about this topic with us, which really poses the question, why are parents rejecting vaccines? We have Jennifer Wright, who is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Colorado at Denver. She is the author of the award-winning book, Fixing Families, Parents, Power, and the Child Welfare System. She was the co-editor of Reproduction in Society, and her new book, which is the topic of our show, Calling the Shots, which delves directly into the much-debated topic of childhood vaccines. Jennifer, welcome to Answers for the Family.
I'm so happy to be with you today.
Well, you've certainly tackled a topic that has been in and out of the news now for the last few years. So I think the first question would be, why did you choose this topic? What is your feelings on it? And why did you have enough of a passion about it that you felt that you needed to write a book about it?
So when I started thinking about this as a project, I was living in California. and I had finished my first book and was trying to think about other places that families are making decisions for their children. And this is clearly a very different kind of topic than looking at the child welfare system. But in a lot of the same ways, parents are interpreting law and policy, making decisions for themselves, interacting with institutions like schools, and trying to decide what makes them feel like a good parent or at least a good enough parent. And those are the questions I find most compelling. At the time I started thinking about this, I was living in California, and there were sort of two simultaneous conversations happening around me. One was an increasing stir of distrust of vaccinations and parents increasingly starting to opt out of them in small numbers. And on the flip side, we were having conversations when George Bush was president about the possibilities of bioterrorism and what that would mean for first responders. And I started thinking that this was a really interesting juxtaposition, that on one hand, we expect public systems to make sure we're all safe, that we can't see weaponized viruses, that we can make sure we are protected against threats of other kinds, at the same moment that parents were rejecting an intervention that protects their children in much more pedestrian ways. And I thought it was a pretty interesting opportunity to start thinking about the intersections between parents' decisions, their views of public policy, their understandings of expertise in health, and how they make sense on the ground every day as they try to do what's best for their children. And that was a decade ago I started thinking about this. And so I think if anyone had told me then it was going to take me 10 years to make sure I got the story right, I don't know that I still would have done it. But it was the right way to kind of follow the question through the ins and outs that you mentioned, where the topic has really evolved and moved forward in really interesting and complicated ways in that time period.
Well, you know, I think one of the things that has come out at the same time is this huge distrust of big pharma and of big corporations as a whole, but specifically big pharma. What are some of the findings that you have had in regards to their involvement, and is it something that we should really be worried about, that they're having that much influence on the decision makers in regards to either our legislature or the experts who are making the decisions on if this is something that's good for us or not?
So one way I approach this question is to, you know, I started with, really the question of like, what are parents doing when they're faced with this decision? Sometimes in the first 30 minutes of becoming a parent, they're asked to start making vaccine decisions. And over this last decade, I've talked to parents who choose to opt out of some or all vaccines, but I've also talked to pediatricians, vaccine researchers, members of federal regulatory boards. I've talked to complementary health providers to really try to understand this from as many perspectives as I could capture. And what I really look to is, you know, where are the points of disconnect and how people can understand the same question in different ways. And I mention this because I think it's a really important way of thinking that, I think that parents who don't vaccinate are sometimes described in ways that they're ignorant, that they're not informed, that they're stupid, or they're armed with an internet education in very dismissive ways. And at the same time, parents who distrust vaccines tend to be very, very confident in their dismissal of all expertise. And what I was really aiming to do was to try to bring these perspectives into conversation, so it was a little bit less bifurcated, that we could find some common ground, that we could see points of disconnect. And what you're mentioning is that this question of trust is really profound. When we ask people to vaccinate their children, what we're asking them is to please participate in public health, to make sure that members of the community who are most vulnerable are protected, even if they can't be safely vaccinated themselves. And we're asking people to work together as communities and absorb some minimal risk to themselves or their children. And to do so, we have to trust that all aspects of vaccines have been fully vetted, that they're as safe as they could possibly be, that they're well measured, they're well manufactured, that the manufacturing facilities are inspected and as safe as possible with all known science. And that's the question that parents often highlight as a point of distrust, so that they're not sure that the federal regulatory bodies that are responsible for ensuring that the safety of vaccines is upheld and constantly monitored is good enough. And to your point about, you know, pharmaceutical companies and their role, in the U.S., we have really trusted public health to for-profit corporations. So we've really looked to pharmaceutical companies to manufacture not just vaccines, but other life-saving medications, and we expect them to do so ethically in ways that that they have some profit motive to do and, in fact, are legally obligated to make a profit. Researchers point to the great disagreement about how profitable vaccines really are and whether they're profitable at all. But for parents, whether or not they want to trust their children's health to those companies remains a question that, they're not entirely on board with.
Well, and I know some of the statistics that those that are against the vaccine, some of the statistics that they bring out, for instance, one of which, because we just did a show in regards to autism, is the huge rise in autism. And I've seen to where they've tried to tie it to the influx of greater vaccines. So again, I've seen that. Now, at the same time, I've also seen it tied to the change in our diet. So I'm not saying that one is accurate or the other, but what was your findings in regards to those that were tying it to certain things that we were seeing within our children?
I had imagined when I started that autism was going to be a much more pressing concern of the parents I spoke with, because there had been so much media coverage starting in the early the mid to late 1990s, right, when the U.S. began looking at mercury content in seafood and other environmental sources and looked to vaccines as well, at the same time that there was research in the U.K. suggesting that there was a connection between the vaccines and autism and the process in the gut that might yield these kinds of mechanisms. What I found in talking to parents is that their concerns are often more diffuse. So occasionally I talk to parents who say autism is their greatest concern, but often what I hear is something more general, that they're not sure that it's entirely safe to act upon the immune system in young children. And how do we know that that doesn't have long-term results in 30 or 40 years? So how do we know that the safety profile, which might be okay in the immediacy, doesn't have long-term consequences? And some of those might be autism, but really what I heard was questions about autoimmune disease, rising rates of diabetes in adults, that rising rates of multiple sclerosis and other autoimmune diseases, and a general sense that they didn't feel that the science was clear enough to make them believe that vaccines were entirely safe. Now, that calculation only makes sense alongside a different calculation, which is how necessary are vaccines. So what I find is that parents are often engaging in a somewhat complicated process of evaluating the risk of disease, the risk of infection, and also the severity of the diseases we vaccinate against, and stacking that up against any concerns they have about the individual vaccines that are recommended for children in order for them to attend school or childcare settings. And in those calculations, they may overestimate risk and underestimate benefit, but I think they're gathering as much information as they can and trying to make what they feel is the best decision for their own children.
Well, that makes sense. Now, you mentioned mercury, and I read that mercury at one time was in many of the vaccines of the past, and they were then connecting it, as you were saying, that the research that was done in England to some of the problems with vaccine. Is it true? And if so, is it true that the mercury has now been removed from the vaccines? Because I had also read that. I'm getting feedback on my own voice.
It's because we all want to hear you twice. So in terms of mercury, it's an interesting question. You know, the history, and I spent some time in the book explaining this history because I found it so fascinating myself. Most of the research we have about the dangers of mercury come from methylmercury and studies of that compound specifically. The vaccines that we're using, thimerosal, is an ethylmercury compound. So it's actually a different chemical compound that's metabolized differently in the body. The problem is there's not a lot of research on ethylmercury. And so a lot of the conversations that were happening in the late 1990s and early 2000s around this question were doing the best they could to extrapolate what was known from methylmercury research and estimating how that might work with thimerosal. So there was no, all the research at that time shows that thimerosal had no long-term health consequences that could be identified. And some of the studies are quite powerful, looking at countries with nationalized health care where half the country had vaccines with thimerosal and half didn't. I mean, very high-powered studies. And nonetheless, at the time, the advisory groups responsible for vaccine safety made the decision that to be under the precautionary principle, to be as safe as possible, there was no reason to continue to use thimerosal in vaccines, and so it was removed. When I talked to parents about this, like, don't you feel better? Thimerosal is no longer in vaccines. The challenge is that all vaccines still need a preservative if they come in multi-dose vials. So often we send out vaccines in vials that can be used for several different immunizations, and there's syringes that are going in and out of the bottle. And in history, we have examples of contamination of those vials. So all vaccines have some that have multi-dose vials have some kind of preservative. So what happened when thimerosal was removed is that other kinds of preservatives still needed to be used. And parents now, when I talk to them about that thimerosal is gone, now point to the other kinds of preservatives as equally concerning to them. And so, again, it's not like one concern, like we've solved thimerosal, we don't think it causes autism, so it's okay. What I hear from parents is that it's a much more generalized concern about the long-term health of children stacked against how necessary is it to really vaccinate against these diseases that very few people have seen in their lifetime.
And now you mentioned some of the surveys that you've seen where they've handled, they've done a support or a group to where half of them had this in it and half of them it didn't. I mean, we've all been getting vaccines now for a very long time. What are some of the results that tells the experts that it's still a positive?
You know, when I talk to parents who are concerned about vaccine safety, I do talk to a handful of parents who are hardliners. They don't believe any vaccines have any value. I've talked to parents who say that vaccines don't really work, that polio would have disappeared by itself, and that the vaccine got credit for that. And that's a very numerically small portion of the population. The vast majority of parents we're talking about, and it's worth remembering, it's a very small number numerically, but it's not nothing. So in California, which in some ways looks a lot like Colorado, where I conducted a lot of my interviews with parents, there's a portion of kindergartners, for example, in Colorado, which still has the exemptions that California has since eliminated, that don't vaccinate against any vaccines. And that's, we hover around 7 to 9%, which is pretty high nationally. But when we look more generally about whether parents are following recommendations for all vaccines, what we find is close to 20 to 25% of American parents are opting out of some vaccines or are administering them in a schedule other than the one recommended by experts. And to me, that's really the more compelling question, is once we start getting as high as 20 or 25% of parents who are not trusting the recommendations provided by panels of scientists and professional organizations, including the American Academy of Pediatrics, then I think we have to take a different look about what counts as knowledge, what counts as expertise, how do we know when to trust recommendations? And to me, as a sociologist, a very compelling question is, what does it mean when parents trust their own judgment more than they trust an entire body of national scientists about when vaccines are necessary and which vaccines are important? And that, to me, is a much more pressing question.
And what is the answer you came up from that?
I think like all things, it's complicated, which is how it takes a decade to tell a story. So there's a lot of different aspects to this question. So from parents' perspectives, what I heard often was that some vaccines feel more necessary. And I use feel often because parents frequently cited their intuition and their sense of their own children as a powerful motivator for when to make decisions about vaccines. So many said things like tetanus, which is ubiquitous in the environment but not actually contagious person to person, was a very important vaccine. Many cited polio as a vaccine against a disease they believed was really serious. But many parents pointed to things like varicella, which is chickenpox, as something that they felt was really not a compelling argument for a vaccine. I actually talked to parents who said that they didn't really believe that the vaccine against whooping cough was very important, and that if their kids became infected, they felt they could really manage that disease themselves and keep their children safe long term. And those are much more complicated sorts of calculations that make very little sense to people who study vaccines, who create vaccines, who license vaccines, and who monitor them, because they see the severity of these diseases very differently than parents.
Now, I know that there was, and there's a variety of different vaccines, so I think one of my questions, will be, is there a higher rate of adverse reactions to one type of vaccine over another? But one of the ones that was in the news just a few years ago, and it was one that I think all girls and I think around 10 to 13 years old or whatever, we're supposed to get. And I know that, and I can't remember the name of it now, but there was a, it was a lot of pushback from parents that really were not in agreement with this particular one. What was that one? What was the argument? And what did you learn about that?
So you're thinking of the vaccine against the human papillomavirus, HPV, and it's marketed by Merck under the name Gardasil. There's a second vaccine on the market called Cervarix. Excuse me, that was licensed in Europe first. And the HPV vaccines, I think, are a really interesting example of how parents make vaccine decisions. So the HPV vaccine is recommended for everyone now, not just girls, to be administered sometime after the age of 10 or 12 up to the age of 26. It's administered in 3 doses, and it protects against the most carcinogenic strains of a virus that's virtually ubiquitous on university campuses, for example. So something like 80% of young people come in contact with HPV. And HPV is the leading cause of cervical cancer. It's the, I think, the sole cause of cervical cancer, and is now also linked to head, neck, throat, and anal cancers. So we know that it's a virus that causes cancer, but not all strains of HPV do, and that a certain portion of people who encounter HPV will manage to clear the virus from their system themselves without vaccination. So parents often look at this vaccine in ways that are somewhat perplexing to them. Do I really need to vaccinate a 12-year-old against a disease that comes from sexual contact? It's not necessarily intercourse, but it comes from any kind of genital contact with someone who's infected. Do I really need to do this? Is it the kind of thing that's really necessary? And when parents start asking these questions, how necessary is this, they're stacking it against their perceptions of what are the benefits of this vaccine? Is that a powerful enough case to make? Do I trust the safety monitoring enough of a new vaccine that did receive expedited approval because it was the only vaccine on the market against this potentially lethal disease? And so those are questions for a new vaccine that doesn't have a long-term track record. And parents really spend a lot of energy evaluating this necessity question against the safety question. And I think HPV, as one of our newest vaccines on the market, really speaks to that tension very directly, because it's also about sexual contact. It also brings opportunities to think through, how might my child behave as an adult? How, as a parent, can I support different kinds of health practices without vaccination? And is this really necessary? And I talk to a lot of parents who talk about the ways their parenting will support their health without vaccination.
And what was the side effects that they were claiming that they were so against?
The range of side effects that have been described with HPV are complicated to understand. There was a report mostly on YouTube of a woman who could only run backwards. She lost the ability to run forward after vaccination. I've talked to a lot of researchers who say that they can't identify any biological plausibility by which that could be true. The more common side effect that people talk about, it's supposed to be a very painful vaccine. It does cause, I think it has one of the highest rates of people fainting after vaccination. And so that's like a short-term effect. And then in terms of long-term effects, it's pretty hard to identify significant risks that come with it. And I should just say, though, that it's also really hard to understand long-term causality anyway. And so knowing, you know, did this vaccine change something fundamentally that I might not know for a long time, is a harder one to know. If I talk to vaccine researchers, they point to this vaccine actually as one of the greatest accomplishments of science, so that it has no viral protein in it. It uses a very complicated technology to really hone in on exactly the kinds of viral response it wants from the immune system, so there's not any other antigens in it. That's very precise. And as of a few months ago, it looks like the efficacy rate, so its ability to prevent it, is better than was expected. So that sounds, from a scientific perspective, from the medical community's perspective, like a win. From a parent perspective, hearing that something is perfectly manufactured, that it has nothing natural in it, it's entirely synthetic proteins, sounds actually more terrifying than reassuring. And that for many parents, the idea that this entirely unnatural substance will be injected into my child's body actually is anxiety provoking, not reassuring. And that's, you know, an example of the kinds of disconnects in how we talk about these questions.
Wow. I love the fact that you have gathered so much information in regards to this, because it was one of the things that I was looking at a time, you know, when you mentioned about the 90s, and, you know, my kids were young, and I was a room dad in the class. So it was a topic of conversation with some of the other parents, what do we do? And, you know, one of the things that I think is great about you putting out this book is that there really wasn't any information. In other words, you know, we would try to find out as parents, but, you know, there would be a piece of information that would come out, but then, you know, then there would be someone else that would have something that would be the exact opposite, and we'd go, okay, well, what do we believe then? So I love the fact that you have put together so much great information in regards to a subject that I think a lot of us were really very uneducated about. Now, for everybody out there, stay with us. We're going to take a break, but I want you to know we will be right back. And again, the topic is why parents are rejecting vaccines. You're listening to Answers for the Family.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family, and we are talking with Jennifer Wright, and we are talking about her new book, Calling the Shots: Why Parents Are Rejecting Vaccines. And if you are just now tuning in, she has spent 10 years gathering as much information as possible to be able to help educate all of us as parents, you know, to be able to know, I mean, what is the real information out there? And especially in this day and age of internet information, you can probably find an argument to almost anything. You can find an opposing argument out there. So Jennifer, again, I appreciate you coming on. I appreciate you putting together the book. And one of the questions that came in, and this is one that came in from a listener, this one reads, my main concern as a parent is the presence of aluminum in vaccines. I have confirmed in my research that it is added to half of all vaccines to boost their effectiveness, although some experts claim the amount of aluminum contained in vaccines is safe. I have seen studies in infants that haven't proven that. What does your research show regarding this topic? And this is from Francis J.
Francis sounds like a really diligent parent who's doing a lot of reading and information gathering. And I think that's like a really important thing to recognize that, so often parents who distrust vaccine claims are dismissed as not thoughtful or as ignorant or as inconsiderate or selfish. And I think this is a great example of a parent who's working really hard. Aluminum is one of the new preservatives that's used to replace thimerosal. And I think it is in about half of vaccines based on their multi-vial usage. And in terms of the safety studies, you know, one of the complicated questions I think we can always come back to is, what do we think of the power of the studies? How well conducted were the studies? Are they well designed? What kind of evidence do we have? And then who do we trust with that information? And I think that's a really important question to ask. I think parents should be asking questions. They should ask them of their pediatricians, and there should be dialogue about it. there is concern about aluminum as a heavy metal. The studies I've seen say that it does it's in small doses and it does not accumulate in the body the way some heavy metals do. And so its safety profile, as I've read it, looks pretty good. I'm a sociologist. And so I try not to make any claims of understanding the chemistry of these kinds of issues. But I think it's a great way of pointing to this question about who do we trust and who do we ask? What I found was that there's really two simultaneous pressures culturally that parents are responding to that meet right at vaccine questioning. One is that we have this cultural moment, I think, where parents are being asked to assume responsibility for everything that happens to their children. We are told that parents, you know, have to pick the perfect school for their kids, to make sure they have the perfect diet, that they're not home alone for too long, but they have some independence, that they have the right extracurricular activities, that their college applications are coming together, that there's a huge amount of parents to invest in their own children, and not a lot of conversations about worrying about everyone's children and other people's children. And simultaneous to that cultural thread, this kind of individualist parenting, we do something very similar around health right now. So we ask people to track their calories, to monitor their steps, to keep track of their, you know, their fitness, to assume personal responsibility for all of their health. And when we hear people become ill, we often ask, what did they do wrong to become sick? Not, you know, what did we as a community do not to support better health for everyone? What we know is that most of disease has environmental factors to it. It's not entirely individually controlled. And yet the way we talk about managing risk, I argue, correlates perfectly with the way we talk about parents being the gatekeeper for all good and bad outcomes of their children. And that the collision of these two moments has placed a lot of pressure on parents, I would say probably like Francis, to feel like you have to, and it sounds like the parents in your classroom too, that you have to do perfect research, that you have to understand the science, that you have to make decisions, because if you're not asking these questions and making decisions for your own child, then it's hard to feel like you're a good enough parent. And more generally, outside of like the individual choices of individual vaccines, this larger conversation concerns me more, which is this moment where we can say that as long as my kids raise enough money to have PE, it's okay that other kids in the same city don't. That we really have taken away concern for, I think, kids throughout the community in ways that carry different risks, so that it's not only about making the perfect decision for one's own child around things like vaccines, but that all these decisions have complicated repercussions for others in the community, and I don't know that we talk enough about that.
Yeah, and I think you bring up a good point, and I know that as a room dad, one of the things I learned the hard way was when you go in for the first time as a kindergarten room parent, you know, you catch all the things that all the other kids have because you're not used to it. So it was one of those things that some of the room parents were, or the room moms were telling me, oh yeah, well you have such and such because it's your first time ever doing this. Well, one of the things that it did was I then never got sick again, on the first day of school, because I had built up a resistance to all of those new childhood diseases. But at the same time, so were the other kids. So is there also that argument of, well, you know, by putting them around other kids and by getting some of these things, that's how your body builds up a resistance to it. At what point are we protecting so much? And when you mention about the individual, the person who's working on their own individual child, by them not doing that, being the one that doesn't, are they bringing whatever that they're not immune to into the school? Are they now bringing something into the school that is now putting others at risk? Is that part of the issue here?
Yeah, I think your experience as a room parent, I think, is a ubiquitous one when kids start preschool or any kind of group school environment, whether it's preschool or kindergarten. All of a sudden, we put a bunch of small people who are prone to sharing bodily fluids and not washing hands well all together in a room, and they're absolutely going to pool disease. And some of the earliest requirements for vaccines came after smallpox, which required that. And so I should say that those laws requiring vaccination against smallpox correlated historically with the rise of laws requiring school attendance. And part of the rationale was if we're going to put kids in a classroom together, they're going to increase their risk. And so to be in that classroom, you have to participate in protecting everyone. This larger question of what does it mean to build up a healthy immune system is one that I found parents think a lot about. So we talked about HPV being an entirely manufactured vaccine, and that feels wrong. Parents, I found, made a very powerful differentiation between natural and artificial, and that getting a disease and fighting it off is a natural immune response. And many voiced concern that if we vaccinate, maybe that's a lesser response for the immune system, that many vaccines require boosters frequently, and maybe that's a sign that this is not as high quality immunity long term, and that maybe it would be better if kids get measles and then recover from it, and then they would have lifelong immunity. Or maybe it's better they get whooping cough and that they recover from it, because the whooping cough vaccine is not a particularly effective vaccine long term, so it requires a lot of boosters. Maybe it's better to get it naturally, fight it off, and have lifelong immunity. And it's a compelling argument. The problem is that what we know is that not all kids will succeed in fighting it off, and that not all kids are equally well equipped to do so. So we have examples like measles, where in California, you pointed out 147 people were infected. They then went home and traveled from Disneyland, and many more were infected. I think it spread to Canada and Mexico as well. And there aren't, as far as I know, any reported deaths from that epidemic. And so you can say, see, measles was a nothing disease. It used to be ubiquitous in childhood. People got it and they recovered. And so why are we even vaccinating against it? Maybe it's better everyone gets it. The problem is that something like measles would affect about 1 in 10,000 children would end up with brain swelling, which could lead to blindness, deafness, or death. And we know historically that that's exactly what happened. And there's really no great way to predict whether your child is that 1 in 10,000. We know something similar about influenza right now. So flu is another example. There's huge arguments about whether it's good to vaccinate against the flu or bad to vaccinate against the flu. But what we know is that we vaccinate for the flu in large part to protect the most vulnerable people in our community. So that's seniors who are the most likely to be devastated, babies who are too young to be vaccinated, that are likely to be significantly harmed by it, are better protected when everyone's vaccinated against the flu. And also that even amongst healthy young people, there's some number who die every year of flu, and it's not predictable who those are going to be and whether it's your child or my child. Now, parents I talk to often feel that they put so much work into being a good parent, that they have high quality nutrition, that they eat organic food, that they breastfed their children, that they work so hard to promote their kids' immune system, that they imagine that their kid's not going to be that 1 in 10,000. And statistically, they're probably mostly right. The problem is we never know. And so vaccines are an insurance against having to find that out. But it's definitely a complicated trade-off. I would say with the example of whooping cough, which, you know, as you've seen, I'm sure, in any advertisement or parenting magazine, we're asking teenagers to be vaccinated again against diphtheria, pertussis, and tetanus in adolescents, and we're asking new mothers to be vaccinated. It's a horrible disease if you get it. It's known as the 100-day cough in Chinese medicine. I've talked to people who've broken their ribs from coughing for 3 months. But if you're an adult or even a teenager, you're likely to survive whooping cough. The problem is that 50% of newborns and babies under the age of one will be hospitalized with whooping cough or with pertussis, because for them, it's a very different and much more risky disease. And so when we think about why are we vaccinating teenagers, it's because a lot of them babysit and they live in the same communities as babies, and those babies become really vulnerable in a very different kind of way. And so all of these decisions, I think we think of them as individual choices for our own children, but they absolutely have repercussions for everybody, and that's a much more complicated calculus.
Well, as I was preparing for this show, one of the things that I was trying to look at part of the information that's out there, and I ran into one of the things called the slow vax movement. So share with us a little bit about that, to where it's people that appear to not necessarily be against vaccination, but that they want it done slowly or stretched out over a longer period of time. Share a little bit with our listeners about that.
Yeah, I think this is the most pressing question right now on the landscape. And so when I talked about that as many as 20 or 25% of parents are not following the recommendation as issued by advisory boards and professional organizations, what parents are doing as they gather information and make decisions, is they're treating each vaccine as a unique decision. So I think when we talk popularly, we think like there's parents who are against vaccines and parents who are for vaccines. And what I find is actually there's a lot in the middle. So I talk to a lot of parents who say, I'm in favor of vaccines. I just don't know that they need them right now. Or I don't trust the way that they're given. Or it feels like too much too soon for a small baby. So to take a step back, one of the things I learned in the course of this research is how we have vaccine schedules. And any of your listeners can look online, and the CDC and the American Academy of Pediatrics publishes the schedules. You can look at the bar charts. And what you'll see pretty quickly is that most vaccines are recommended very early in life. In the first 2 years is like the most vaccines. And most parents will remember taking their kids in and having these rounds of vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's not a lot after two until kindergarten, and then there's a whole bunch again. And so looking at that schedule, what you see is it seems overwhelming that you're going to poke my child, which by itself, I think as a parent, is a horrible experience to watch. And then you're going to give them up to five vaccines in a visit against five different diseases. That doesn't make any sense intuitively when I have this tiny baby who is, you know, all of 10 pounds maybe, and you're going to inject them with all of these substances that feel unnatural. And this is a much more, I think, intuitive feeling. And I talk to parents who just talk about how it didn't feel right. So what parents are often doing is reading and thinking and examining each vaccine and trying to interpret whether it sounds like it's really necessary at the time it's offered. So I talked to parents who said, I believe in the polio vaccine. I want my kids to get the polio vaccine, but we live in the United States. There hasn't been polio in the United States since the 1970s. Do I really need to vaccinate against polio when my child's one? Why can't I do it later? It doesn't make sense to do it now, and their immune system will be more developed later, and so it feels right to just delay that vaccine. And parents are increasingly looking at each vaccine and making these decisions. There are some best-selling books that recommend different alternative schedules, but I'm also finding that parents often craft them for each of the children in their family. So they may decide that one child needs certain vaccines more than another, or that one child they perceive to be more vulnerable, and so they don't want to give them to them in the same order. They might have a child. I heard often parents point to their child who has food allergies or eczema or something that they perceive to be malfunction of their immune system, and so they didn't want to give vaccines in that order. So one of the questions we can ask then is, so what? If they're going to eventually vaccinate against polio, does it really matter if they don't do it now? Or if they don't want to do the vaccines in the order recommended, how does it matter? And so I think that's a really important question to think through. And one way I tried to answer it was to understand how it is that these vaccines end up on the schedule. So I interviewed people who are on this federal advisory board, Committee on Immunization Practices, and asked questions about how it is. And what I heard often was that members of the committee look at all data and all studies they can identify on a vaccine, and they look at not just the safety of that one vaccine, but they look at how it interacts with other vaccines on the schedule, so that when they place it, they're looking at, some told me, as many as 800 interactional studies, so that it might actually make the vaccine work better to be given in combination with other vaccines. It might get a better immune response. And so it's fairly deliberate where they place them. They also consider when are kids most vulnerable to that disease, so that you can take something like we talked about whooping cough, which is recommended early in life. Well, you can delay it, but the greatest consequences for infection are actually very early in life. And so delaying it may minimize the benefits that vaccine can confer.
Well, and I think you just touched on a huge question that maybe a lot of people would have. And as you were talking about it, I was having it as well, which is, you know, how do they interact with each other? You know, we know that putting things in our body, you know, that, you know, doing one thing at the same time as the other don't mix. We don't mix alcohol and narcotics. You know, they don't mix well. It causes a different reaction. So it would seem logical that getting all of these at the same time could cause a different reaction. I'm glad to hear that they're actually studying that and saying that by doing this together, it actually makes it work better. That makes perfect sense, because as you were talking about it, I was thinking, well, logically, how long does it take the body to build up an immune system, knowing that most vaccines are just giving you a little bit of whatever that disease is so that you can build up an immune system to it? So
what? Yeah.
I was going to say, if we're doing five at the same time, are we doing that because it's convenient for the doctor or because they are working well together?
Yeah, and those are, I think, really important questions. And I think there's some tension around that. So we tend to give vaccines at, you know, recommended at the at similar times and similar doses to all people, because it makes it relatively inexpensive to do them. And it makes it easy for parents to not have to come in for many appointments. So what we find with parents who exercise a slow vax schedule is that they are paying much more in copays if they come back for frequent appointments. So parents might decide they only want one vaccine at each visit, but they're going to come in three times more often to come in to get those vaccines. Mm-hmm. So for some parents, that might not be a burden. But what we know is that for others, that could be really hard. And that in the U.S., we talk a lot about parents who opt out of vaccines by choice. But it's worth remembering that the greatest number of unvaccinated children in the U.S. are children who lack access to consistent medical care. And their parents aren't necessarily distrustful of vaccines, but they don't have consistent access to a provider on a schedule, and that they may not bring their kids in regularly based on factors ranging from transportation to work schedules to other obligations and costs. And so, you know, thinking about that tension, I think, is important when we think at a community-wide level. Whether they work better in combination, there's some good evidence that the immune response in some vaccines is actually a better response from the vaccine, and in others, the disease itself might be better. And the ways that they're looked at in combination vary, and I think they are well studied. Now we can go back to the question we started with, which is how trustworthy are those studies and those experts, and are those the people we want monitoring vaccine safety?
But
from what we know and what's out there, it looks like it's a pretty safe schedule for most children. And for those, there's a handful of children, I think, who have underlying medical conditions, and individual providers do customize them. One of the important ways that I had to start thinking about this question you give a little bit of what you want, like a little bit of the virus or whatever. And what I heard from parents, their version of that was often, why are we giving the same dosage to an 8-pound baby and a 200-pound football player? And I thought that was such a good question.
It is.
It doesn't sound right. So I started asking people who are on ACIP and I talked to one person who is a vaccine inventor, and I said, why is this wrong? Like, why are parents wrong in this thinking? And what he explained, which was really helpful, was he said, vaccines are not medication. They don't have a volume of distribution in the same way we do dosages for other medications. And so when we think about it, if I sneeze on an 8-pound baby and I sneeze on a 200-pound football player, it's not like the football player gets less sick because I only sneezed once. That the immune response to that protein, right, works really differently. And I thought that was a really useful way of thinking about this as a different kind of response to the immune system. It's not a medication in the way we usually think about medications. And that helped me think through about this question of overwhelming the immune system. Because if you do get sneezed on, your immune system kicks in no matter the quantity or times you're sneezed on. The other thing that I heard that I found helpful to think through was that as engineering has become better and science has become better, vaccines are able to isolate the proteins that we want and not as much stuff that we don't. So that even though we may be vaccinating, let's say, against five different antigens, there's a lot of evidence that there's fewer proteins in those five than there was in the one vaccine against polio in the 1950s, because they weren't as well able to isolate that. So there might have been, you know, thousands of other proteins that we didn't intend to pass on that were included in those vaccines. And so in many ways, it might actually be less biologic information, which, again, it doesn't feel intuitively true. But I did find it useful to try to understand from a scientific perspective what that might mean.
Yeah, it sounds like what you're saying is that, you know, I mean, less is more, that as we learn more about how to do these things, we're able to dial it down in such a way that we're really more targeted rather than sort of more of a shotgun approach. Does that sound about right?
I think that the target is, yeah, that the, like when we say we just want to vaccinate against this one protein, we can isolate that one protein in new ways. But we are absolutely vaccinating against more diseases than we did 30 years ago. And so the vaccine schedule that many of us grew up with had many fewer vaccines on it than kids today are facing. And so for some parents, just the sheer number of increase sounds like too much. that many of us remember having chicken pox, which was dreadful, but we all survived it. And so it may feel like sort of biomedical excess to vaccinate against many of the diseases we now include on the schedule.
Wow. And anyway, I just looked at the time. You know, I could go on for, you know, for another hour in regards to this. I think this is an incredibly important topic. And for anybody out there that would like to get the book or to get more information, where is the best place for them to go for that?
The book is available from Amazon and other booksellers. And then I have some information if it's useful to your listeners. My website is jenniferreichphd.com, and there's some links to other resources there. But I'm absolutely happy to share anything that's useful, because I think these are really complicated decisions. And at core, the most important thing is we all want what's best for children. And so I think figuring out what that is that feels right is really important.
Oh, you got that right. And again, for anybody out there, if you're driving and you can't write these things down, please go to our site, answersforthefamily.com. We have all of Jennifer's information on there. Jennifer, thank you so much for coming on. Again, I think it's an incredibly important topic. And I know that I've learned a lot, you know, just by listening. So again, for everybody out there, you know, if you want to get the book, you can go, you can pick it up at Amazon, or again, go to our site and you can get all the information in regards to Jennifer. So Jennifer, again, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're great. And for everybody else out there, please be sure to put on your calendar and tune in next Monday, which will be December 26th, when we will be replaying one of the most timely and popular interviews with best-selling author, psychologist, Dina Cabrera, about her book, Holiday Stress, Avoid the Trap of Emotional Eating. And having that the day after Christmas, come on, it's got to be the perfect thing. So for everybody out there, be good human beings. Be with us again next week on Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polachek, only on LA Talk Radio.